Our Divinely Inspired Constitution, an address delivered by Elder Dallin H. Oaks, a member of the Council of the Twelve Apostles of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The address was delivered at Brigham Young University on July 5, 1987.
Not long after I began to teach law, an older professor asked me a challenging question about Latter-day Saints' belief in the United States Constitution. Earlier in his career, he had taught at the University of Utah College of Law. There, he met many LDS law students. They all seemed to believe that the Constitution was divinely inspired, he said, but none of them could ever tell me what this meant or how it affected their interpretation of the Constitution. I took that challenge personally, and I have pondered it for many years. This year we celebrate the 200th anniversary of the United States Constitution. This is a good time to re-examine how that Constitution was established and to reconsider the meaning of our belief that it was divinely inspired. The United States Constitution was the first written constitution in the world. It has served us well, enhancing freedom and prosperity during the changed conditions of 200 years. Frequently copied, it has become our nation's most important export. After two centuries, every nation in the world except six have adopted written constitutions, and ours was a model for all of them. No wonder modern revelation says that God established our constitution and it should be maintained for the rights and protection of all flesh, according to just and holy principles. George Washington was perhaps the first to use the word miracle in describing the drafting of our Constitution. In a 1788 letter to Lafayette, he said, "It appears to me then little short of a miracle that the delegates from so many different states, which states you know are also different from each other in their manners, circumstances, and prejudices, should unite in forming a system of national government so little liable to well-founded objections." End of quote. It was a miracle. Consider the setting. The 13 colonies and 3.5 million Americans who had won independence from the British Crown a few years earlier were badly divided on many fundamental issues. Some thought we should reaffiliate with the British Crown. Among the majority who favored continued independence, the most divisive issue was whether the United States should have a strong central government to replace the weak League of Friendship established by the Articles of Confederation. Under the Confederation of 1781, there was no executive or judicial authority, and the National Congress had no power to tax or to regulate commerce. The 13 states retained all their sovereignty, and the national government could do nothing without their approval. The Articles of Confederation could not be amended without the unanimous approval of all the states. And every effort to strengthen this loose confederation had failed. Congress could not even protect itself. In July 1783, an armed mob of former Revolutionary War soldiers seeking back wages threatened to take Congress hostage at its meeting in Philadelphia. When Pennsylvania declined to provide militia to protect them, the congressmen fled. Thereafter, Congress was a laughingstock, wandering from city to city like a homeless nomad. Unless America could adopt a central government with sufficient authority to function as a nation, the 13 states would remain a group of insignificant, feuding little nations, united by nothing more than geography, and forever vulnerable to the impositions of aggressive foreign powers. No wonder the first purpose stated in the new United States Constitution was in order to form a more perfect union. The Constitution had its origin in a resolution by which the relatively powerless Congress called delegates to a convention to discuss amendments to the Articles of Confederation. This convention was promoted by James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, two far-sighted young statesmen still in their 30s, who favored a strong national government. They persuaded a reluctant George Washington to attend, and then used his influence in a letter-writing campaign to encourage participation by all the states. As the delegates assembled, there were ominous signs of disunity. It was not until 11 days after the scheduled beginning of the convention that enough states were represented to form a quorum. New Hampshire's delegation arrived more than 2 months late because the state had not provided them travel money. No delegates ever came from Rhode Island. Instead of reacting timidly because of disunity and weakness, the delegates boldly ignored the terms of their invitation to amend the Articles of Confederation and set out to write an entirely new constitution. They were conscious of their place in history. For millennia, the world's people had been ruled by kings or tyrants. Now, a group of colonies had won independence from a king, and their representatives had the unique opportunity of establishing a constitutional government, Abraham Lincoln would later describe as of the people, by the people, and for the people. Deeming secrecy essential to the success of their venture, the delegates spent over 3 months in secret sessions, faithfully observing their agreement that no one would speak outside the meeting room on the progress of their work. They were fearful that if their debates were reported to the people before the entire document was ready for submission, the opposition would unite to kill the effort before it was born. This type of proceeding would obviously be impossible today. There is irony in the fact that a constitution which protects the people's right to know was written under a set of ground rules that its present beneficiaries would not tolerate. It took the delegates 7 weeks of debate to resolve the question of how the large and small states would be represented in the National Congress. The Great Compromise provided a Senate with equal representation for each state, and a lower house in which representation was apportioned according to the whole population of free persons in the state, plus 3/5 of the slaves. The vote on this pivotal issue was 5 states in favor and 4 against. Other states did not vote because none of its delegates was present or its delegation was divided. Upon that fragile base, the delegates went forward to consider other issues, including the nature of the executive and judicial branches, and whether the document should include a Bill of Rights. The success of the convention was attributable in part to the remarkable intelligence, wisdom, and unselfishness of the delegates. As James Madison wrote in the preface to his Notes on the Constitutional Convention, "There never was an assembly of men charged with a great and arduous trust who were more pure in their motives or more exclusively or anxiously devoted to the object committed to them. Truly, our Constitution was established by the hands of wise men whom the Lord raised up unto this very purpose." The drafting of the Constitution was only the beginning. By its terms, it would not go into effect until ratified by conventions in 9 states. But if the nation was to be united and strong, the new Constitution had to be ratified by the key states of Virginia and New York, where the opposition was particularly strong. The extent of opposition coming out of the convention is suggested by the fact that of the 74 appointed delegates, only 55 participated in the convention, and only 39 of these signed the completed document. It was 9 months before 9 states had ratified. And the last of the key states was not included until a month later, when New York's convention ratified by a vote of 30 to 27. To the miracle in Philadelphia, we must therefore add the miracle of ratification. Ratification probably could not have been secured without a commitment to add a written Bill of Rights. The first 10 amendments, which included the Bill of Rights, were ratified a little over 3 years after the Constitution itself. That the Constitution was ratified is largely attributable to the fact that the principal leaders in the states were willing to vote for a document that failed to embody every one of their preferences. For example, influential Thomas Jefferson, who was in Paris negotiating a treaty and therefore did not serve as a delegate, felt strongly that a Bill of Rights should have been included in the original Constitution. But Jefferson still supported the Constitution because he felt it was the best available. In other words, we should not expect perfection. We certainly should not expect all of our personal preferences in a document that must represent a consensus. We should not sulk over a representative body's failure to attain perfection. We are well advised to support the best that can be obtained in the circumstances that prevail. That is sound advice, not only for the drafting of a constitution, but also for the adoption and the administration of laws under it. It was a miracle that the Constitution could be drafted and ratified. But what is there in the text of the Constitution that is divinely inspired? I see divine inspiration in the great fundamentals of the Constitution. Number one, the idea of separation of powers was at least a century old. The English Parliament achieved an initial separation of legislative and executive authority when they wrested certain powers from the king in the Revolution of 1688. State constitutions adopted during the Revolution distinguished between the executive, legislative, and judicial functions. Thus, a document commenting on the proposed Massachusetts Constitution of 1778 speaks familiarly of the principle, quote, that the legislative, judicial, and executive powers are to be lodged in different hands, that each branch is to be independent, and further, to be so balanced and be able to exert such checks upon the others as will preserve it from dependence on or a union with them, end of quote. Thus we see that the inspiration on the idea of separation of powers came long before our constitutional convention. The inspiration in the convention was in its original and remarkably successful adaptation of the idea of separation of powers to the practical needs of a national government. The delegates found just the right combination to assure the integrity of each branch, appropriately checked and balanced with the others. The second great fundamental, a written Bill of Rights, came by amendment. But I think we all look upon the Bill of Rights as part and parcel of the inspired work of the Founding Fathers. The idea of a Bill of Rights was not new. Once again, the inspiration was in the brilliant practical implementation of pre-existing principles. Almost 600 years earlier, King John had subscribed the Magna Carta, which contained a written guarantee of some rights for certain of his subjects. The English Parliament had guaranteed individual rights against royal power in the English Bill of Rights of 1689. Even more recently, some of the charters used in the establishment of the American colonies had written guarantees of liberties and privileges with which the delegates were familiar. I have always felt that the United States Constitution's closest approach to scriptural stature is in the phrasing of our Bill of Rights. Without the free exercise of religion, America could not have served as the host nation for the restoration of the gospel. which began just 3 decades after the Bill of Rights was ratified. I also see scriptural stature in the concept and the wording of the freedoms of speech and press, the right to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures, the requirements that there must be probable cause for an arrest, and that accused persons must have a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury, and the guarantee that a person will not be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The Declaration of Independence had posited these truths to be self-evident, that all men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that governments are instituted to secure these rights. Our inspired Constitution was established to provide a practical guarantee of these God-given rights, and the language implementing that godly objective is scriptural to me. Number 3, another inspired fundamental of the Constitution is its federal system, which divides government powers between the nation and the various states. Unlike the inspired adaptations mentioned earlier, this division of sovereignty was unprecedented in theory or practice. In a day when it is fashionable to assume that the government has the power and means to right every wrong, we should remember that our Constitution limits the national government to the exercise of powers expressly granted to it. The 10th Amendment provides the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited to it by the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. End of quote. This principle of limited national powers with all residuary powers reserved to the people or to the state and local governments which are most responsive to the people is one of the great fundamentals of our Constitution. The particular powers that are reserved to the states are part of that inspiration. For example, the power to make laws on personal relationships is reserved to the states. Thus, our laws of marriage and family rights and duties are state laws. This would have been changed by the proposed Equal Rights Amendment. When the first presidency opposed the ERA, they cited the way it would have changed various legal rules having to do with the family, a result they characterized as a moral rather than a legal issue. End of quote. I would add my belief that the most fundamental legal and political objection to the proposed ERA is that it would effect a significant reallocation of lawmaking power from the states to the federal government. Number 4, perhaps the most important of the great fundamentals of our inspired Constitution is the principle of popular sovereignty. The people are the source of government power. Along with many religious people, Latter-day Saints affirm that God gave the power to the people, and the people consented to a constitution that delegated certain powers to the government. Sovereignty is not inherent in a state or nation just because it has the power that comes from the force of arms. Sovereignty does not come from the divine right of a king who grants his subjects such power as he pleases or is forced to concede, as in Magna Carta. The sovereign power is in the people. I believe this is one of the great meanings in the Revelation, which tells us that God established the Constitution of the United States that every man may act according to the moral agency which I have given unto him, that every man may be accountable for his own sins in the day of judgment. Therefore, it is not right that any man should be in bondage one to another, and for this purpose have I established the Constitution of this land. End of quote. In other words, the most desirable condition for the effective exercise of God-given moral agency is a condition of maximum freedom and responsibility. In this condition, men are accountable for their own sins and cannot blame their political conditions on their bondage to a king or a tyrant. This condition is achieved when the people are sovereign, as they are under the Constitution God established in our nation. Fifth, there is divine inspiration in the fundamental underlying premise of our whole constitutional order, the rule of law and not of man. All the blessings we enjoy under the United States Constitution are dependent upon the rule of law. We should be law-abiding citizens, supportive of our national, state, and local governments. The 12th Article of Faith declares, "We believe in being subject to kings, presidents, rulers, and magistrates in obeying, honoring, and sustaining the law." The Church's official declaration of belief states, "We believe that governments were instituted of God for the benefit of man, and that He holds men accountable for their acts in relation to them. We believe that all men are bound to sustain and uphold the respective governments in which they reside." End of quote. Those who enjoy the blessings of liberty under a divinely inspired constitution should promote morality and practice what the founding fathers called civic virtue. It is part of our civic duty to be moral in our conduct toward all people. There is no place in responsible citizenship for dishonesty or deceit or for willful lawbreaking of any kind. We believe with the author of Proverbs that righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. The personal righteousness of citizens will strengthen a nation no less than the force of its arms. We should also be practitioners of civic virtue in our conduct toward government. We should be ever willing to fulfill the duties of citizenship. This includes compulsory duties like military service and the numerous voluntary actions we must take if we are to preserve the principle of limited government through citizen self-reliance. The single word that best describes a fulfillment of the duties of civic virtue is patriotism. We should be patriotic. My favorite prescription for patriotism is that of Adlai Stevenson. Quote, "What do we mean by patriotism in the context of our times? A patriotism that puts country ahead of self. A patriotism which is not short, frenzied outbursts of emotion, but the steady and tranquil dedication of a lifetime." End of quote. I close this talk on our divinely inspired Constitution with a poetic prayer for America. Our fathers, God, to Thee, author of liberty, to Thee we sing. Long may our land be bright with freedom's holy light. Protect us by Thy might, great God, our King. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
You have been listening to an address delivered by Elder Dallin H. Oaks, a member of the Council of the 12 Apostles of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Elder Oaks' topic was Our Divinely Inspired Constitution. The address was delivered at Brigham Young University on July 5th, 1987.